And we are now talking about regaling and reminiscences of regents and rabbis, or rulers and rabbis. The fact is that the rabbis, some rabbis, were deeply engaged with, at least according to the Talmud, with people in Rome, local governors. For instance, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who wrote the Mishnah. He lived in the north, in Sipori or in Sepphoris, and other cities, and he had a relationship with the Sanzinonus, whoever it was at that time, Marcus Aurelius. And there's a wonderful story about him and their very close relationship, a learning relationship, actual learning together. Obviously, some rabbis were put to death by certain leaders, and particularly Hadrian. And we also know that Rabbi Gamliel used to have a certain haircut, and his family, the leaders of Israel, had to have certain haircuts so they could go to Rome once in a while and look more Roman, perhaps. And that was okay, so they could, you know, save the Jews.
What kind of haircut was it?
Mistaper kumi safa. I don't know. Maybe it's some kind of mustache or something. I'm not sure. Maybe they shaved the mustache. I'm not sure. But in any event, tonight I wanted to focus on Rabbi Yehoshua. Tell you the truth, I never really focused so much on Rabbi Yehoshua. We always talk about Rabbi Eliezer, the one who argues with, who was very flamboyant, and he was actually thrown out of the academy and put into Cherem. He died in excommunication. We talk about their student, Rabbi Akiva. We talk about Rabbi Akiva's friends. We talk about Rabbi. But Rabbi Yeshua seems like we have a story that he was very poor, but this story doesn't make it seem like he's so poor. A working man, he made coals for a living. This story makes it seem like he was rubbing shoulders with the very important people. He was the Rosh Beit Din. He wasn't the Nasi. He wasn't the leader, whatever they called the leader in those days. Today translates as president, but meaning the head of the community. Not the political head, but the other. Come on in, Tani. Plenty of chairs here. There's a chair. Why don't you pull that around the circle so we'll have a little circle here? He was the Av Beit Din. He was the head of the court of the Sanhedrin, and no question, he was very, very learned at the absolutely highest levels. I mean, it doesn't need my approval. Matter of fact, you have here from Pirkei Avot, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who basically, you know, brought Judaism from the temple outside the temple because he was the transitional chief rabbi. Or Nasi, or head of the community there, first in Jerusalem, then in Yavne, he said that he had five students, and one of them was Rabbi Yehoshua. And he said that, like, some of them he commended for being like a cement cistern that doesn't lose a drop, or in other words, a very good memory. But Rabbi Yehoshua, he said, happy is he who bore him. That he's just such a pleasure. His mother should be proud to have such a child. So we're going to learn about him. There's a little description of his physical appearance and his connection with the emperor in that connection, and we'll just read that for a second. Steve, you feel it?
Okay.
Okay. So
the emperor's Hadrian daughter said to Yehoshua ben Hananiah.
So there's other in.
Deep research on this. The
Sansino claims that the emperor was Hadrian. I don't know. That seems kind of odd that such a deep relationship would be between this Hadrian, who eventually was responsible for putting down the Jewish rebellion, and would have such a deep relationship with the rabbis. But who knows? Could be. Let's go on.
So the emperor's daughter said to him, Yehoshua ben Hananiah, such comely wisdom and ugly vessel. He recognized that he was very wise, but
she was very disturbed by how his outward appearance didn't match his wisdom.
He replied, learn from thy father's palace. And what is the wine stored? In earthen jars, he answered. But all people store wine in earthen vessels, and thou too, likewise. Thou keep it in jars of gold and silver. So she went and had the wine replaced with vessels of gold and silver, and it turned sour. Thus said he to her, the tower is likewise. But are there not handsome people who are learned too? Were they ugly, they would be even more wanted.
They wouldn't have all the temptation, right, of being handsome, so they'd probably study more. So just a cute little exchange, and gives you a sense that we know that he made coals for a living. Maybe he had already graduated to something else by the time he's rubbing shoulders with the emperor. But maybe he's just a Caesar. It's not the word Caesar is used. Caesar, I don't know. It's hard to know who the exact figures are. Sometimes even the names, the Talmud's written hundreds of years later. It's hard to know exactly who the exact figures are. Okay.
I have a question.
Now,
why did the woman turn sour?
Oh, you can't store things. You can't store. For instance, if you stored your wine and your silver all the
right.
time, it wouldn't last. But
silver
but
turns, right?
Yeah. By the way, just a little biographical excursion, and then we'll get back to our main passage. I just want to focus on one passage today because it has 12 pieces to it. That's
wow.
enough for tonight. But just one comment. Number one, there's a wonderful book. My cousin had recommended it. Aaron Feldman, who subsequently became the Rosh Yeshiva at Ne'er Israel, and his brother was a rabbi in Atlanta. He wrote this wonderful book, but it's really based on the commentary of the Vilna Gaon, and I even have the Hebrew printed edition of some of the pages in the back of his commentary on some of the stories we've done. Focuses on the story we're doing tonight, because it's so rich, and the story we did the first week of the sea monsters and all that. So that's very interesting. The unbeknownst to me, all these years, I've always studied the Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev. Everybody knows about him, and he loved the Jews, and he would always try to judge Jews favorably, and Hasidic Rebbe of early days, but his commentary, like most Hasidic Rebbe's, goes according to the portion of the week. In the back, he has stories of the Talmud, Agadot HaTalmud, and he goes deeply, essay by essay, into the 12 stories of today's book. Also, there were Jews who found it hard to study the halachic, the legal parts of the Talmud, so they became Ein Yaakov Jews who like to study Ein Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Kuli, who you know from Bar Mitzvah speech fame, and he put this together. I don't know exactly how it works. A friend of mine wrote a dissertation about him, but he put together the Rashi, which we all need, the Maharsha, who was one of the few commentators from about 500 years ago who made an extensive commentary. And it's found in the volume of Talmud, but also his other little commentaries as well. And Chidush HaGaonim, will be referring to some of the others. That's always good
Did
to
you
have.
Say that
no, no, no. The only thing, the five volumes of Ein Yaakov, is only things in the Talmud that are not laws.
Oh.
He skips every law and only talks about things that could be qualified as Agadah. What's Agadah? Everything in the Talmud that's not law. Now, the some of which are stories, and that's what we focus on here. The Ben Yehoyada is a Sephardic commentator from the 1900s, from the 19th century, and he Yosef Chaim, I believe, of Baghdad, and we've mentioned him many times over the course of time. And this particular week, he apparently talked about it somewhere else. His book was running out of space. He says, "I get to the end of the Talmud. I wrote about it somewhere." Anyways, I have to look into where that is. I must say that the regular Schottenstein edition of the Talmud, they're very good on Agadah. I think recognizing that some of these stories for the lay reader would be absolutely ridiculous, they recognize that they needed to go in more depth on the Agadah than on other things. And so, for instance, on this page, they have 10 pages describing this page, which even in halachic pages, they rarely go more than 4 or 5 pages. Here they have, I think, 9 or 10 pages just on these stories. So, with that introduction, let us begin Bechorot. We're in the order of the Mishnah known as Kodashim. We're talking about sacrifices. We're talking about Bechorot, the firstborn animals which went to the Kohen. And somehow they're talking about serpents, and somehow they meandered into this story, which is a one whole page long. So, let's start out. The emperor once asked Rabbi Shuv ben Chanan. Now, the story comes in two parts. One is the introduction to the story of the eventual encounter of Rabbi Josh or Rabbi Yeshua, whose full name is Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, Rabbi Yeshua with Caesar, with the emperor. I don't know his name. First, the whole story of how he got to have this showdown, and then we'll deal with the actual showdown. So I don't want to focus so much on the introduction to the showdown. I want to focus more on the actual showdown. Someone had asked last week if they had disputations, public disputations, and I sort of waffled on the question. I'm sorry, this is a sort of public, maybe not so public, but this is some kind of, it's presented as a disputation between the rabbi and the sages of Athens. All right, so, Joe, if you wouldn't mind reading this for us.
Let me just make sure I got this all set over here. Oh yeah, I wanted to mention one more thing.
There's another book that's found on HebrewBooks.org, Nazir and Tiffin, another book written by a rabbi whose name I mentioned earlier,
who wrote a whole book just on this Agadah that we're studying tonight. 127 pages.
Okay.
The emperor once asked Rabbi Joshua ben Hananiah, how long is the period of gestation and birth of a serpent? He replied to him, 7 years. But did not the sages of the Athenian school couple a male serpent with a female, and they gave birth in 3 years? Those had already been pregnant for 4 years. But did they not have sexual contact? Serpents have sexual intercourse in the same manner as human beings. But are not the sages of Athens wise men?
Okay,
I'm going to have to explain that. They assumed that
if they had any, if they were pregnant, they wouldn't have any sexual contact, unlike human beings. So they said, no. He answered, so they saw they had contact within the 7 years, so they must have not been pregnant. He said, no, they're like human beings. Even if they're pregnant, they could still have contact.
Are not the sages of Athens wise men? Surely they must have ascertained the true facts about the serpent. We are wiser than they. If you are wise, said the emperor, go and defeat them in argument and bring them to me. He asked him, how many are the Athenian sages? 60 persons. Thereupon he said to him, make me a ship containing 60 compartments, each compartment containing 60 cushions. And he did this for him.
Okay. So surely this is laden with lots of symbolism. Now, what do you think? Do you think that the emperor, the way it's presented here, does the emperor want him to win or lose? Yeah, why do you say lose? No. Once he says, I'm very smart, so then he says, well, then fine, go and defeat them. He doesn't go back and forth from that point on. He says, go and defeat them. Any other comments? Do everyone agrees with Lisa? He wants the Greek, he's Roman, he wants the Greek sages to win.
Well, he says, if you are wise, as you have been down.
Okay.
He kind of said, I know you are wise.
Right.
To
good. Okay, very good. So it's ambiguous. Nazir Nitzachon, this rabbi whose name with an F will come back to me later, he died in the early 20th century. He claimed that the emperor was happy to spend lots of money making a big ship so that the Romans should be more learned. They should learn from the Jews. There is such an idea. Surely these stories contain a kernel of historical fact that there were Romans who were intrigued with Judaism. It's a fact. Okay, moving along.
So that would say that he was on the side of the rabbi.
Possibly. Yes. But yes, the Nazir Nitzachon, he believes that, yes, definitely. Now, at each juncture, we're going to ask some questions in the italicized section. The Athenians base themselves on natural observation. In other words, let's assume they're the proto-scientists who, you know, didn't Aristotle make the categorize the species and things like that?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So, what is the rabbi's basis for knowledge? The Torah, right? Prophet, right? So, if the Athenians are basing themselves on observation, the question is, what do you know? So, so it's a good question, and the answer would have to be something to the effect that the rabbi, in saying 7 years, it's not, he doesn't mean 7 years. It has nothing to do with the gestation. He could care less about what the gestation period of a snake is. For him, it means something else. He's referring to something else. And that's much wiser and deeper, and it comes from our tradition, and it comes from our Torah, more than, you know, actually knowing the physical
about a
snake, right? Now, we also know, some of the commentators point out that in Shabbat 55b, it points out that Jesse, that's David ben Yishai, right, David's father, he's referred to as a snake. There's a verse somewhere in Samuel that seems to indicate that, in, I think chapter 2, verse 27, I think it says that that he is, that the verse that says snake is actually referring to Nachash, is actually his father. Because he, the only sin he has is a sin of the snake, the original sin. He doesn't have any other sins. David's father was very, one of the people who had no sin. So, so David is a prototype of Mashiach. And then it says in Sanhedrin, there will be 7 years leading up to Mashiach. There will be a 7 year period, maybe seven periods of years, but a period of seven something or other, 7 years before the Mashiach comes. And there'll be rumors that he's coming, there'll be earthquakes, different things, wars. And in the, I'm sorry, it says seven, it says in the fifth year, there'll be prosperity. Fifth, sixth, and seventh, the Roman saying Mashiach, it starts with prosperity. And the rabbi is saying that Mashiach starts with the other things like rumors, wars, famine.
That's now.
Right. So right. So
talking about Roman.
No. They lived in the time of the Romans. That's a fact. The Palestine was under the Romans during this period. The Romans. Let's see. Rabbi Yeshua is a student of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai lived in the transitional period as the temple is being rebuilt. As the temple is being destroyed. That's the year 70. The Romans destroy the temple, and the Romans remain in power. So we're talking about the Romans. Now, but we're referring to the scholars of Athens because, I don't know, Greece, scholarship and knowledge is associated with Greece. In those days, it's all Rome anyway. Now, so the Gentile world, we're going to talk sort of in broad strokes here. The Gentile world, so to speak, believes that redemption starts where? In the fifth year, which is what?
Prosperity.
Prosperity. When there's prosperity, that shows redemption is coming, right?
So,
right?
The
what? Right. So when Christians look at the world and they see that over the centuries, Christians did well, Jews are, you know, not so great, right? So to them, their Mashiach is coming, ours is not. Right? But that's if you assume a 3-year gestation period. But if there's a 7-year gestation period, if Mashiach takes longer to sort of brew, and it starts with the years of famine, the 7-year cycle, famine, wars, other stuff, then, right? So what?
That's why he said 7 years for the birth of the
snake. Right. Now, this is very creative.
Oh, yeah.
Is this right? Now, obviously, that can't be what he said. Right? It can't be what he said to the emperor, because the emperor wouldn't understand the symbolism, right? So, well, we'll see later that, you know, this.
So this is written down for us.
Right. We'll see later. The Maharal is going to talk about that a little bit later. Let's go on. Suzanne, welcome back.
Thank you. When our Joshua reached their city, he went up to the slaughterhouse. He found a certain man who was dressing an animal. He asked him, "Is thy head for sale?" The other replied, "Yes." Thereupon he asked him, "For how much?" And the man answered, "For half a zuz." He gave him the money. Eventually he said to him, "Give me thy head." He gave him an animal's head. Thereupon, Rabbi Joshua exclaimed, "Did I say the head of an animal? I told thee thy head." Rabbi Joshua then said to them, "If you wish that I should leave thee alone, step in front of me and show me the door of the school of the Athenian sages."
No, this is typical of stories, not just Jewish stories. There's always, before you get into a nice juicy story, there has to be a what? True. he's trying to get to the Athenians. He's supposed to go to the Athenians, but he gets to Athens, he doesn't know where they are. Yeah. So there has to be a secret passage. There needs to be a secret passage. So this is the code.
Thereupon the man replied, "I am afraid, for whoever points them out, they put to death." Rabbi Joshua said, "Take a bundle of reeds, and if you reach the spot, throw it down as if to rest."
Okay, so we'll continue with this in a minute. Now, what is this business? He told man he wants his head. What does it mean? Okay. Now, he doesn't want the knowledge from the man, though. So what is he telling him?
How much for you?
Yeah. He's giving him an animal's head.
Head as...
Okay, you're taking head as a leader, you're taking head as intellect. Let's go with the intellect. The head is something to do with intellect. So he's telling him... So this is how some of the commentators think. That he's telling him, why don't you delve into wisdom, you foolish butcher? So he says, well, you know, animal, man, they're all the same. He says, no, you should aspire to higher things. He's afraid he doesn't want to disconnect the physical from the spiritual, from the intellectual. So something like that. So I didn't do much research on that, but something along those lines. Good question. Right. It's interesting. Are we interested in uplifting all the the Greeks or the Romans? Interesting. All right. Anyway, not our main study for today. Let's go on.
He went and found guards inside and guards outside the school. For when the wise men saw somebody enter, they used to kill the outside guards. And when they saw someone leaving, they killed the inside guards.
Okay, now, in our Rebbe story, Rebbe Yudah Anasi, the Rebbe Judah, the prince story, where in the Talmud of Borosara, when he meets up with Antinonus, in that story, wherever that is, all the guards always get killed. So the Jewish image of the outside world is a world where there's a lot of murder. There's killing people like crazy. Go on. So he has to play a special trick, which reminds me of some Hasidic story.
He reversed the heel of his shoe, and they killed the inside guard. Oh, I'm sorry. And they killed the inside guards.
He lets someone do
it. He then reversed the shoe to its normal position, and they killed all of them. He proceeded and found the young men sitting high up in the upper chamber and the elders below. He said, "If I give greetings to the elders, then the young men will kill me." The latter claiming, "We are more important, for we sit high up and they sit below. And if I give greetings to the young men, then the elders will kill me." The latter claiming, "We are older and they are just youngsters." Rabbi Joshua then said, "Peace to you."
Okay, before we actually get to the meeting, so the idea that where do they put the elders? Above or below?
Below.
Put them below. So this, according to some who want to see this, the oncoming debate as a debate between major philosophies of the Greeks and the Jews. So the Gentile wisdom comes from sort of today. Whoever's observation today. I can make a better observation today than you could yesterday. But Jewish wisdom comes from the old times, so the old people are more important. We see it very much today with squared with the computers and all that. But one might argue that this distinction was always true. Yes? Oh, good. Show me your... take off your head. Right. Sell me your head. Right. I'll give you money, and you give me the head. Good.
Right. Or just take me to the cave.
Yeah.
Take
very
me to the.
Cool. Yeah.
Very good. Excellent. Good. Show me the head might mean show me the leaders. Good. All right. Continue.
Okay. Rabbi Joshua said, "Peace to you." They asked him, "What are you doing here?" He replied to them, "I am a sage of the Jews. I wish to learn wisdom from you." "If so, we will ask you questions," said the Athenian wise man. He answered them, "Very well. If you defeat me, then whatever you wish, do unto me. But if I defeat you, eat bread with me in the ship."
Right. So he's got some sort of plan he's been working on for taking them on this ship with 60 seats or 60 cabins for 60 wise men.
With 60 pillows.
With this. No, there's 70 nations. Yeah, those who are looking for symbolism see in the book of Song of Songs, there's Shishim Giborim Savivla, that around Solomon's bed there are 60 strong men. And so the strong men, people have strong men, people, you know, Solomon happened to have been a Jewish, you know, he was a Jewish man who had strong men, but generally it's the Gentiles who had the strong men, and they would have 60, so it's powerful. Mm-hmm. Oh, good, good. Yeah, we did use that symbolism in the first story. That's right. So a similar type story of Rabbah Bar Bar Chana in our first week, the Rabbah Bar Bar Chana stories in Bava Batra. We like 60 towns and things like that. And some of the commentators said 60 is the Shah. So they have their sages, and we have our Talmud, our 60 tractates of Talmud. Good. Yes. Inshallah.
Okay, so he wasn't using plural, like,
right,
trying not to single out one.
No, right.
Right.
Yeah. If you take this all very literally, you know, the rabbi's very rude to the butcher, and all these people are just being killed, and nobody seems to care. Right. But
also, he takes a weird risk. So he's saying,
yes, right. Very, very supernatural that he thinks that he's so sure he's going to win, he's not even worried. He makes a very bad deal. Okay, now, we're now going to deal with the 12 debates that they have, 12 things that they throw at him. Some of them aren't really questions, but some of them are riddles, different things that they're going to throw at him, and we're going to try to interpret them. Now, so here are some questions to think about. What will they argue about? How can we interpret the stories to indicate debates of different things, such as when is Mashiach coming? Okay, we already talked a little bit about that. Like, is Mashiach coming after prosperity or after trouble? As the Gra would have it, the Vilna Gaon, his commentary, which showed in Rabbi Feldman's book, is based on the Vilna Gaon's interpretation, lived 300 years ago or so, or the plight of the Jews, right? As the Maharsha, the rabbis found in the back of the Talmud from 500 years ago, Ashkenazi commentator. He would have it. In other words, the major question the Gentiles have for the Jews is, what? If you're so smart, right? Why is your whole world falling apart, right? The temple has been destroyed. You have no sovereignty, right? Or the focus on the physical versus the spiritual world, as the Maharal would have it, the scientists versus the religionists or the prophets, or the students, or the children of the prophets. Mind you, the Maharal thinks this never happened. Okay, the Maharal, each week we've been looking for different commentaries who said, this is a metaphor. And here we have it. I didn't look at the Maharal, but as they quoted the Maharal. Anyway, it's a caricature of the positions of the Greeks and the Jews. I use the word caricature as my own expression. But in other words, we're trying to lay out the position of the Jews versus Gentiles in this story form. You could also say that it happened, maybe not exactly in this way, or this is the way we tell it, so that we can understand it. So, you know, I don't know, you know, who knows? We don't know which part is historical, not historical. Anyway, but there is that option of viewing it just way out there as just this big story that's being written to lay out for the Jews the difference between Jews and, you name it, Romans, Greeks, Gentile world, non-Jewish world, etc. Okay.
Well, it's hardly apologetic because, you know, the Greeks and the Romans are the language and religion.
It's not. So
sophisticated, while recruits of the Romans, you know, like, have these...
Right. Well, wait, one second. Wait a second.
Just reading this debate.
Whoa, one second. Right. At the simple level. Okay. Right. So clearly there were times when rabbis would get up, and just like today, you have to entertain the crowd. People fall asleep. People get tired. So you got it, right? The Talmud talks about that. So a lot of these stories could be, entertainment for the crowd. We mentioned last week that who were we studying last time? The Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, he got upset. Everyone went to the other rabbi who was talking about the stories. He's talking about the law. Everyone went to the other rabbi, so he got upset. So we know that this it's used for that purpose. But the idea is not sophisticated. I'll have to take issue with that. The commentaries that we're reading are trying to read into these silly kind of 12 little silly exchanges between a rabbi and the Greeks as sophisticated discussions. Basically, this Nezer HaNitzachon, I believe, is basically saying it parallels the 13 principles of faith. So, and different issues, you'll see, you'll like it. Different issues that do come up in... Right, that could be. Right, that's anachronistic, that's true. But because being 13, actually it's 12, but he's going to address certain issues that actually do exist within non-Jewish thought. Please, I'm not an expert in that. If anybody has comments about ways it relates to the reality of Greek or Roman thought, I welcome that. Okay, let's go on. Let's see. Let's go on. Here comes story number one. Let's see. Tani, can you help me out? Read. Okay, so.
They said to him, if a person wished to marry a woman and the consent was not given, is it feasible that he should seek a woman of higher birth? He took a peg and stuck it below on the stone wall, and it would not join. And then he stuck it higher up, and it went in. He said, here also, therefore, it may happen that the second woman is his destined one.
So what's the problem, right? There's a man who wants to marry a certain woman. So she's of, let's say, let's say she's a peasant. Now she says, oh, I don't want to marry you. So now does he go and try to marry the noble woman?
He could.
Right.
He could. Well, what is his stature? That's the question.
No, logically he can't. If even the peasant rejects him, then Kalvachoyre. Yeah. Yeah.
Certainly. But psychologically.
Right. Right. That's what he's saying, is that, what do you mean? Relationships are not cut and dry. We can't debate relationships.
It depends.
Chemistry, Bashar, all kind of. Yeah. Destiny. So who knows? Now, what could... Yes. Right. And what?
University.
She moved up. Right. That's right. So, what could this be a metaphor for? What fundamental issues that Jews are dealing with, and dealing with the powers of the powers that be? Who would be the person of higher birth in a Jew-Gentile conflict when they're asking the question to us, who's the higher one?
In their minds.
We are. What? Right. He might be asking, it's hard to say. They might be asking, according to you, who you think you're so high. We all know Jews think they're, supposedly think they're better or whatever. So, according to you, so you're the person of higher status. That's one possibility. The other idea is that, of course, we're talking about the Gentiles. So obviously, each nation thinks, and they have a right to it, that they're the best, right? So it could be that. So that's, let's see. So let's take a look at these two little hints over here. What if it's talking about the afterlife? How would this read? So this is those who are interested in talking about the afterlife, right? Maybe the Gentiles don't have the same belief in the afterlife. Maybe they have
They have a different type of belief in the afterlife. So how would it read for them that if you were married to someone of a lower status, what's that?
This world.
This world. Hmm. And how do we do in this world? How do we fare in this world? How do the Jews fare? We don't fare too well. And then you expect that in the next world, which is much better, you're going to do better? Nonsense, right? So what is the answer?
Yes.
Yeah, see, sometimes it works. You know, somehow you get, it doesn't work over here in this world, the gate nisht, it doesn't go.
But you don't get the reward here.
Right.
And it's hopeful that you don't get the reward.
Right. That's,
that you will get it.
Right.
And the next
life. Right. We will actually get back to that point later. Right. So that's one reading. So that if we're interested, if you anachronistically want to read, you want to preach about the world to come, so you use the text that way. But the idea that Jews and Gentiles, what does Aristotle say about the afterlife? He says
that the soul dies with the matter.
No. Okay. So that would work well. They don't believe, at least for Aristotle, thank you, he doesn't believe in an afterlife. We do, so that could work as something they might be arguing about. Or maybe the Maharal wants to talk about that. But here's the Vilna Gaon. The Torah was first offered to the Gentiles. So, figure it out. The Torah was first offered to the Gentiles. And what did they say?
No.
They said no. Who's God going to go to next?
The
Jews?
Maybe we were lower on the end of the pile.
So he said, yeah. You, right. Okay. So again, does this have to do with the station of Jew versus Gentile? Does it have to do with philosophy? So there are two possibilities. Okay. Story number two. Let's see. Would you go on fourth, please?
If a man lends money and is compelled to seize his debt by force, is it to be expected that he should lend again? He replied to them, a man goes into a forest, cuts the first load of wood, and cannot lift it. He continues cutting until somebody comes along and helps him lift the bundle.
So you make a loan to Shlomi, right? So you give a loan to Shlomi, and Shlomi default, right? So then, I was supposed to go in the loan business, and it was going to be good. And it turns out he defaults. So do you stay in the loan business? Right? You leave the loan business. So what's the answer?
You keep cutting.
Right. I mean, well, you cut a load. You can't lift it. So what do? You cut some more, and hopefully someone will come along who's really strong and he can carry everything. So, in other words, going back to the loan, you make one loan and it fails. So hopefully, what do? You lend it to somebody else.
And it works out.
And then hopefully it works out. Now, so if we're talking about Right. Would you switch people? Yeah, would you switch people? Right. That's a good question. So now, if we're interested in the relationship of Jew and Gentile, and the selection of Israel as elite people of God, how would this story read? It's interesting. That was more of the last story. Right here, the Jews. You give the Torah to Jews. What happens? You lend them this beautiful thing. They lose the tablets. They lose the tablets. Whatever you give them, they lose it up. And then, do you lend them again? In other words, what?
You keep giving them.
In other words, you just lost your temple. In other words, what is he saying to you Jews? What is he saying to them?
You're done.
It's finished. Right? It's finished. Right? You're finished. So what does he say?
No, you still.
Wait until the Chidush Agonim in the Ein Yaakov, Chidush Gionim, actually. I told you some Hagionim. Oops, sorry about that. Anyway, so he says, let's go back to from before Jewish history. What happened at the beginning of the Bible? God gave the opportunity to Adam. It all messed up. So what did he do? He waited for, well, you could say Abraham. He happens to say Noah. I think Abraham would work out better. Right, you had the flood, and that would work out better in this discussion. This seems kind of random to put that in here. But in any event, you see where we're going. Moving along. So whatever refers to the Jew's second chance, right? That's the Maharal, or the Torah's second iteration. See, the Vilna Gaon is interested in preaching about something else. Talk about anachronism. He's interested in preaching about the idea that you get one Torah, and then you get another one. What's the other one? What's the second Torah?
The oral
Torah. Something like that. I don't know exactly. Moving along. Now we shift to a different type of story. Tani, would you read that for us? Nice that Tani joined us tonight.
All right. They said to him, tell us some not true stories.
Okay, the Chazi.
Like Bar Kokhba, Bar Kuziva, the liar, the fake. So now they want to. The Sanzina just translated tell us a story, but the simple translation is tell us some not true stories. Go ahead. Yes, right. By the way, there may be things that, I know you rabbis, you like to talk about laws are very cut and dry. Can you tell something that's more of a parable? That's not a sheker, he's not telling he's a chazav. The Chidushe Geonim and the Inyaku wants to claim that there's a difference between sheker and chazav. Sheker is absolute falsehood. Kazav is like a fable, where it's true. It's just not hasn't happened yet, as Gregor Wine likes to say. Right. So let's go on.
He said to them, "There was a mule which gave birth, and round its neck was a document in which was written, 'There is a claim against my father's house of 100,000 zoos.'" They asked him, "Can a mule give birth?" He answered them, "This is one of these stories."
Right. He told me to. Lie, right? So I did, right? So, okay. Now, how does Israel's barrenness, why do they say that a mule can't give birth? Yes, I don't know if it's true or not, but there's an
assumption.
Okay, good, thank you. So a mule can't give birth. It's there. Okay, good. It's a mixture of what? Donkey horse. So a mule can't give birth. So he says a mule that gives birth. So who else can't give birth in Tanakh? Who can't give birth? Who's the barren one? Right, Sarah and Rivka. But in the prophets, in Isaiah, who's the barren nation? Israel. Why? Zion is barren because it doesn't have any of its children. Where do they go?
In the world, they're in exile.
Right. So he says, you're barren, right? You can't have it, right? And he says, yeah, it's exactly how that story plays out. I'm not sure. So then he says it's a story. I'm not sure. Now, what else? Kedushat Levi, the Levi Tzvi Ditchiv. What if the mule is the wicked and the child is a good deed? Every time you have you do a good deed, it's your child. Right? It's your brainchild. So he says, can the wicked, the question is, can the wicked what? Can good come from bad? Can the wicked produce good? It's one of they're asking him a philosophical question. Or that's as I saw it reported in the name. Because when I was reading through that lady, it sounded like I saw something else that's very interesting there. In what way does a human being have a sign in their neck that says, "You owe me $100,000"? In what sense does a human being have that sign on their neck? Right, it sounds true, it sounds childish, everybody owes me, give me, right. But in what sense does every human being have a sign on the neck? I deserve $100,000. A child of God, okay, right. You got tenants, good. What, right?
Very valuable.
We're valuable, right. In time. So he says, people kind of go to heaven saying, hey, I was the rabbi, you know, right? I was the cab driver, you know the joke. I did this, I did that. And we've come with a sense of entitlement. He says, the more pious you are, the more you realize, oh no, I'm not there yet, right? So we shouldn't be like that. Anyway, it's an interesting point.
Well, a father in heaven, perhaps. Perhaps. And
you will be viewed as wicked.
Well, it can't produce, it can't do mitzvot. It can't produce the mitzvot. It doesn't have children which are mitzvot in this metaphor. It can't produce the mitzvot. And when it does, and according to him, when it... Well, sorry? Yeah, by the way, this is totally opposite of the philosophy of Levi Berditchev. He's famous for saying that every Jew is great and everyone's terrific. So it's strange. As a matter of fact, you could, if you want to go in that direction, you could take take it the opposite way, that he's saying, no, the rabbi is saying that the mule has children. There could be. Good could come from bad. Oh, good.
Donkey.
Right. This is a mule. Yeah, we're gonna get to Mashiach donkeys later. Good. Okay, good. Good. Now, just for lack of time, let's move on. All right, Charles.
How does this relate to our covenant of God?
When?
When salt becomes unsavory, wherewith is it salted? Let me tell you that again. When salt becomes unsavory, wherewith is it salted?
In other words, if the salt gets spoiled, how do you salt the salt so it won't get spoiled?
He replied, with the afterbirth of a mule. And there, is there an afterbirth of a mule, and can salt become unsavory?
Right. So they said to him, is there an afterbirth of a mule? So he says to them, can salt become unsavory? Can salt become spoiled? Right. So...
What's the Jewish metaphor of salt?
What's the Jewish metaphor of salt? Conservative. What's the biblical image of salt?
Possession.
Preserves. What's not? Possession. Why? Load. Okay, interesting.
Well, the salt could.
Right. Well, there's a verse. Brit Melach. Brit Melach, there's a covenant of salt. All the covenants we have are covenants of salt. I mean, they're preserved. They're well preserved. They're going to stay. The Shabbat and the Jewish people with God.
Yeah.
It's all relationships that are going to stay. So, so let's see. So it's the covenant,
spoiled,
right? They say, what happens when the so-called covenant of salt gets spoiled, right? And he says, right, salt cannot get spoiled.
Yeah.
Let's see. For the afterbirth of a mule, what's that? The Chidush Geonim in the Ein Yaakov, he says salt is related to the sacrifice. The verse in Leviticus, Brit Melach, you have to have salt on all the sacrifice. I believe that's where it is. And so they're saying to him, your temple's destroyed. You don't have any sacrifice. So he says, the afterbirth of a mule, I don't know, maybe we'll use the metaphor from the last one, right? Even the we wicked Jews who lost our temple, we could have afterbirth. There could be, we can do something good. We can have children.
The pun is that just like there is no such thing as the afterbirth of a mule, it exists. So a mule is shot
from right. So, is it right? So then why do the... Yeah. I mean, you don't want to mix, right? Right. The question is, do we have to have a tight metaphors? Right. If they're just meant to be sort of, homilies, it's a way to tell stories so that you can preach about something else. So that they don't have to be tight. Meaning. We don't have to work out all the details. But you're right. In some of them, we're going to work out both sides of it. Generally, the commentators try to work out both sides of it. Sometimes I just don't understand it. But in any event, the Vilna Gaon wants to go in another direction. He says, what if we sin? Who's going to save us? I can't save you. You can't save you. We all sin. So who's going to save us? He said, the afterbirth, meaning the children. The children who didn't sin yet, they'll save us. But he says, really, is there such a thing? He says, don't worry, there is such a thing. Something like that. All right, moving along. Let's see, Rabbi Yoel.
built as a house in the sky. He pronounced the name.
Isn't that great? It's just fun, right?
Pronounced the name of the deity, suspended himself in the air.
Right, now this is a guided thing. We have this David gets suspended, but we didn't get to Yishbi Benov the other week. Why were we doing that? But anyway, Yishbi Benov. There's a story where David wants to save himself, so he says God's name, and his friend says God's name, and he's suspended in the air. So there's an idea that with God's name, you can do all kinds of tricks. There's also the creation of monsters and things like that can be done with God's name. Go ahead.
And hung between heaven and earth, he then said to them, "Bring me up bricks and clay from down there." They asked, "And is it possible to do this?" He replied, "And is it possible to build a house between heaven and earth?"
Now notice, but did he? Did he? In the other cases, he said, "Is it possible?" And he meant it wasn't possible. But here, when he says, "Well, is it possible to build a house between heaven and earth?" Did he?
Well, I assume he says here it's also not possible.
No.
But because even though he himself hangs in the sky,
right,
the bricks will not.
Right. Right. So we need a metaphor for the bricks. We need a metaphor for the house. So what's the house in the sky? What would the Gentiles accuse us of building a house in the sky?
Okay, it's the temple, in which case, what are they complaining about? That the temple, what?
Oh, right. In other words, so then, like, some Christians today say, yeah, forget, you don't have atonement anymore, you don't have anything, you know, right? So you Jews are claiming that you have a temple where?
In the sky.
Pie in the sky. Yeah.
So that's one puzzle. In what other sense do Jews have a house in the sky?
They must remain there a long, long time until the Mashiach comes or whatever is the time.
What would the bricks be?
In a sense, they have a house in the sky.
What are the bricks that you need?
But it can't be built from bricks and clay from this.
Okay.
It has to be built from things that are less physical.
Right.
Such as spiritual, ideal.
Bricks could be mitzvos, in which case you do take it from below. You take it from,
mitzvos are concrete. Mitzvos, you build a sukkah out of stuff that's here. Right, it's filling. It's from an animal down here. It could be, you know. That depends about how, whether we want to take that metaphor, right? Whether when we build these ideas, do we have to take his word for it that you can't do it, or we take the first part of his word that he says you should do it?
It should be
right. There you can.
You're supposed to build your home. Can you build a home? Let me try that. Can you build a home that's in the sky? Can you build a home that's so spiritual and not so physical? Right, maybe that was it. Yes. Yes. I'm not sure we can. That's interesting. I'm not sure, though. One thing. I'm not sure we're going to be so precise about the Hebrew. Bani lan beta ba'avir dam. Yeah, I'm not sure we can.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Maybe you do all these bricks down here to build up a house in the sky, a home. One day God will give us 310 worlds for every righteous person. So it could be. Now,
could it have anything to do with people?
Good.
House
in the sky. Right. We're trying to fix the world. Right. But unlike the modern Tikkun Olam, which is very focused on building bricks and mortar right here, Tikkun Olam in the sense of building a house in the sky. But what's the ultimate Jewish house in the sky? What's the way the Greeks would say, a bunch of house in the sky stuff. What do
God is.
Right, God. What else do Jews engage in? What do rabbis engage in? Right? The study, the prayers. It's all house in the sky. You don't build anything. You don't have bridges. And right, Rabbi Yehuda lives a few generations later. He says, Romans, all they build bridges so the prostitutes can stand on them. And so, he's very dismissive of all the stuff they built. And of course, the opposite as well. They would look at us and say, "You build a house in the sky." Gornish, yeah. So nothing like the word Gornish. So that could be the Kedusha Levi. Levi Yitzchak says, "What is the Jew's house in the sky? It's the Torah, prayers, the teva, the letters, the words that elevate you." So how do we connect with Ruchnius, with spirituality, through the words, the bricks of the mitzvot, and we take those bricks from down here and we elevate them, exactly as you were, along the lines you were going. The Chiddush HaGaonim says sort of a chauvinistic idea that only we know how to do that. That's a Jewish trick. The Hasidim talk about it, everybody talking about elevating the Gashmius type of thing, taking the things below and bring it up in the sky. They can't know, you can't do it. That's what he's saying. You can't do that. Right. We know how to do this. We know you're having Jalant and Google and this, and oh, it's a beautiful spiritual Shabbos. No, it's not. You're having Jalant and Google and Dreplach. You know, where's the spirit over there? So we know how to do that. We put it in the context of mitzvah, fix it up. But the Nezer Nitzachon, who you called anachronistic before, he's trying to make this more sophisticated. He says, I want you to build a house in the sky. You can't do it, can you? Because you can't have creation ex nihilo. You can't have creation from nothing. We believe in, what was it called?
Eternal
matter. And you don't. You believe that God created everything, including the very beginning of matter to begin with. You have the stuff which blew up in the Big Bang. All the stuff before, there was nothing existed forever. That's what you believe. But can you build a house in the sky? Can you build a house out of nothing? Yeah, you can't do it. So your whole concept is nonsense. So now exactly how he responds to that, I don't know. I'd have to read more carefully than Nezer Nitzachon. But so you see, he's trying to bring in issues that are, you know, real Greek issues. See what I'm saying? It's not a bad one, you know.
No,
it's a house in the sky.
I think that it's all nonsense.
How do you know? Why should you come to that conclusion?
Tell us something. Well, because as you see, there's no existing tradition explaining this.
Everyone's
just going with the flow.
Okay, that's an interesting point. Existing tradition. Notice when I gave you the library of books about this, right? I didn't say that Rashi had a sophisticated approach. We didn't talk about the Ramban. The Rashba, the student of the Ramban, he had a little bit of an approach. The Rambam was going to write something. He didn't. He was trying to develop a more metaphoric approach and stuff like that. But we don't really have anything. So, yes, it is later. So, no, I agree that we don't have a tradition about it, but it doesn't mean that once upon a time it didn't have more depth to it. I mean, to say that some of these rabbis were just engaged in, you know, silly stories, I don't know. It's possible. There is entertainment. I hear you. But Right. So that's a possibility.
So it's
right.
Clever.
Right.
I'm not saying it's stupid.
Right.
I'm saying I think you're looking for too much behind. I think it's a collection of.
But that's like saying that this painting, it just is someone who has a lot of books on him. That's what you can't do anything else because that's what it says over there. I don't think anytime you have a work of art, I don't think anyone can claim to have gotten to the end of it. To say that we had these are the greatest interpretations we've given today, that could be correct. That it's not. They're not. Some of them are not tight. Maybe some of them are not presenting properly. But to say that, to look at a creation, human creation, and say that it has nothing else to it, I don't know when you can ever know that. But anyway, it's interesting. It's interesting.
They could be taken as one dimensional, or they can be taken back into infinity or out of us. That's all I'm going to look at.
There's no question that a lot of the rabbis here are building their own agendas. No question about it. Or, well, that gets back to the whole debate of how you look at a piece of art. But yeah, one way to look at it is, I don't care what his original intent. He's created the metaphor for us, which is rich and which has other potentials in it. Yeah. But either way. Anyway, yeah, you're entitled to your opinion. I'm just...
What did Rashi say?
I'm just... No, so Rashi just translates the words. In almost all these stories we've had, Rashma, they just translate the words. Sometimes they have some questions of things that don't fit their knowledge of other things. But, the Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, commented a little bit on the Rav of Rabbi Chana stories. I forgot what he said, but we mentioned it in that lecture. We'll give out the audio of all these lectures today. And the sheets will be on there too. Anyway, we move on to the next point. Let's see, Doctor.
Where's the center of the world? Where's the center of the world? He raised his fingers and said to them, "Here." They said to him, "How can you prove it?" He replied, "Bring ropes and measure it in."
That's very, very cute and clever. Right, but look at the depth here. Where's the center of the world here? What could that mean? Give me three interpretations right now.
Man,
right. The human being. Every human being is the center of everyone's world. What else?
Hashem
is here, right? So, good. Okay, good. Raise the fingers. Okay. I'm not sure if they're raising the fingers. Hold on one second. Hold on one second. One second. Anyway, I don't want to keep you too long, but let's go on.
That whatever you're focusing.
Yeah, he lifted up his finger. Yeah, I'm sorry.
That whatever you're focusing on at any moment is the center of your mind world.
Good. This debate, this is where it's at right now. Where is it at?
It's going to be somewhere
it's
else
at this.
Later.
Right. Yeah. But since we're engaging in something meaningful, it's at here. Where are where are they? Right. I saw someone assume that they were in Israel. But the story seems to be in Athens, so that doesn't work. Maybe as a Jew. Then the Vilna Gaon says, what if they're not asking about space, but time? In other words, it's not the center of the world. Olam can mean, as you know, not just space, but also time. So where's the center of time? Meaning it goes back to what they really want to know is, when is your supposed Mashiach coming? So he says, we're in the middle. And then going through the whole thing the 3,000 years, 6,000 years, and that type of thing. Okay, moving along.
They said we have a
pit in the field. Sorry.
Only one person.
What? Bring it to the town. He replied, not ropes of bran flour for me, and I will bring.
Right. The pit. A well, right? The well is in the field, but he wants to be in the town. Now, there is a midrashic idea of Miriam's well, which what?
Followed her.
So, right. But clearly they're giving him a challenge. Right. So he gives him some other crazy way of bringing it over. Right. Again, kind of comic, humorous. Right. Right. I mean, right. Just to take Yol's point before, there is an idea of humor in the Talmud, right? They say they open up their lectures with something funny. Could be. But taking the other approach, what do we got here? So in Jeremiah 2, it says, you have forsaken me for wells that don't hold water. He says, right, I was a well that was full of living, fresh water, and you took other wells that were broken, they don't even hold any water.
Is that Hashem's?
Right. So then, so who's the well?
Hashem.
The well's Hashem. So he says, and where's the field? Who would be in the field and who would be in the town? Good. Esau, right. Esau is a field, man of the field. Go in the field and get the... Good. So, and also we know the wicked are like chaff. It's a verse in one of the Haftorahs there somewhere. Kamot Hashem Yitpen Ruach. We say it at a funeral sometimes. Anyway, so the wicked are like chaff. So he's saying, the wicked are like chaff. I forgot how that works. You forsook God. I forgot exactly how that works. But the Vilna Gaon says the field belongs to Esav. The brand represents coarseness, sins that we do. So if we want to move forward, we have to get rid of our coarseness. When Esav will dry up one day, you know, we'll be able to be victorious. The Ketushat Levi says, hold on a second. We're the ones who are in town. We have to have more modesty, not be so coarse, and then we can somehow bring the well of fortune, or the which well could represent fortune, or the well of spirit, or the well of God, to bring close to ourselves. All right, let's go on to the next one. Okay, Steve.
We have a record mill staff named. He took a detached portion from it and threw it before them, saying, "Take out the threads for me like a weaver, and I shall mend it."
Right. So he says, you have a broken millstone. The millstone is how you make a living, right? You own a mill. And a lot of our ancestors had mills and stuff. So you don't have a source of parnassa. So you have no way of making a living. But he says that somehow he can... We can mend it. I forget exactly what the second metaphor is. Let's go on. Suzanne?
A bed of knives, wherewith can we cut it?
That's nice. If you had a field that was growing knives, right? Then what would you reap it with? What kind of sickle would you use?
Go ahead.
With the horns of a donkey.
Go ahead.
They asked, but has a donkey horns? And is there a bed of knives?
And don't forget, they asked them to tell stories that are not true. So the Marsha said that sin is the knife, and the donkey is Messiah Zechariah 9:9. Right? So if you want to cut down all the sins, you have to do it with the horn. Horn meaning the glory of the horn is the glory of the Mashiach.
Would it be
shofar? Oh, could be. We have to check the. The karna, yeah, karen. Some people say you can use a karen for a shofar. Some people say you can't. A horn. The Vilna Gaon says that the sword is what Esav lives on. So that's Esav. But the sword depends on using the merit of Esav. And Esav's merit is what's his merit?
That he repented.
No. Most people say he didn't. Ishmael repented. Honored his father. But he said it's going to wear out. It's going to wear out. We're going to be able to... we'll be able to have the Mashiach when Esav runs out of merit. The Nezer and Nitzachon, that 19th century commentary, he says that they're arguing about a philosophical issue, and that is the rabbis generally say. I always want to be old. What's on?
Everybody's yelling.
Philosophical issue. The philosophical issue. Is the we mentioned before that there's a famous philosophical issue about the beginning of matter, right? Beginning of matter, we said that the Greeks believed that was there always matter?
No.
Yes. And the Jews say that there was not always matter. God comes before. What about the end of life? So the rabbis are generally famous for saying that at the end of days, what's going to happen? God will be alone. It's such a statement in Sanhedrin that the end of the world will come to an end. All religious people kind of believe it, right? Anybody ever saw on the corner of a street, right? They always say the world's coming to an end. Now, the Nezer Nizachon is a very sophisticated book, and he says, well, the Rambam and other people thought that it's not necessarily going to end. It could end, whereas they were very certain that matter always was and always will be. The laws of destruction of energy and matter, right? But we have a tradition that it could end, but it could also not end. So the more sophisticated, he says, common Jewish view is that the world will end. Another view is that it might end. It could theoretically end, because there's nothing about matter that must go on. Matter is ethereal. Okay. So, here today, going tomorrow. Now, then that's what they're arguing about. He says, a bed of knives, meaning things that cut, things that get ruined, how can you cut it? It's always going to stay here. So he says, no, after Mashiach comes, it can be cut down. Just an interesting attempt to, it's an interesting attempt to try to put some philosophical, to put some kind of philosophical argument within this Gemara. Moving along, Suzanne, let's see. Which is for Camille.
They brought him two eggs. Which is from the black clucking hen, I'm sorry, and which is from the white. He himself brought them two cheeses and asked them, which is from a black goat and which is from a white.
Yeah, so again,
he tries to make it into a
philosophical debate where do you know things from? You're looking at an egg, you have no way of knowing because you're trying to figure out things now. We have traditions from before. The goat cheese, someone made the goat cheese. You didn't have to, from before. You didn't have to guess, speculation, which egg is this? You're a bunch of philosophers sitting on and contemplating, silly things. We know it from before. We know it from prophecy, from things before. The Marsha is a very acute thing. How long does it take for an egg to gestate? It's like 21 days. We have 21 days of mourning, summer, 21 days of tshuva, and on Yom Kippur we have two identical goats. You guys think that all of our days we're always mourning, even the Yom Kippur, it's all sadness. We're never going to be forgiven for anything. But actually, they're two different goats. One goat is different from the other. It was the goat of atonement. Not every goat goes off the cliff. The Gra thinks it contemplates the similarity, the twinness. Of Jacob and Asa. Moving along, just quickly, I'll read this one. A chicken dead in its shell, where did its spirit go from? Right? How does a chicken egg die? Where does the spirit go? It's locked in to the shell. So he says, once it came, how did it go get in? How did the spirit get into it? So that's where it goes out. So so they think the spirit is physical, the Maharal says. It's a debate about physicality. Or those who are dead, who are already locked in the ground, how are they going to get rewards, says the Marsha. He says, don't worry, in the world to come. Or the Nezer Nitzachon says, you think the spirit comes from within. That's why, let's see, this should be the opposite. They think the spirit comes from intellect and things like that. We say that it comes from outside. I'm not sure how that fits this, but he goes along those lines. Finally, one last one, and with that we will conclude.
Right. So that's right. So then we should say that there is a problem with the egg. How's it going to win? So is that how you would get out? But that's the issue that he puts into this passage. See, we just read the final passage for us. Show us
an article whose value is not worth the loss it causes.
Like you Jews. It's not worth it.
He brought a mat of reeds and spread it out. He could not get through the door being too long and wide.
Levitzik says, if it was modest, it was humble, it could get through the door. It would be more modest. What's supposed to go ahead?
He then said, bring a rake and pickaxe and demolish the door of the building. That is an example of an article whose value is not worth the loss it causes.
So, So the Jews were this. He said, don't worry, God will do everything, turn everything upside down. But would God cast out Israel to replace it with something cheap that's not worth it? Like Esau? Right? So he says, Esau must be more expensive. Going back to the original, or the original metaphors, Esau must be more important because he destroyed Israel. We don't cast out Israel to bring something better, or something worse. So it must be better. In any event, then he brings it back to the Lord. He agrees that he will kill the enemy, but we're not killing them all because they're no good. A story like that where the emperor decides that the rabbi's smarter than the other person, and he gets rid of the rabbi.
So he killed all the wise men?
What? It's not necessarily a true story. It's a story from it's an option. But there's some other stories that we heard. One time the emperor asked him to see God and things like that. But I think what it's all about is
the interesting question. We have something called Agadah. In Agadah, there's some very strange birds, or fish, or eggs, or other things. Is it part of Talmudic humor? Is it part of some sort of metaphors we don't understand? Is it deeply metaphoric? Does it represent deep? Since here we're dealing with Greeks and Romans, does it relate to actual Roman and Greek thinking and theology? Or the rabbis who told these stories lived so much longer after that they didn't even know, they didn't know anything about those things, and were they particularly interested? And it's interesting that in the last 500 years or so, perhaps with a little bit of enlightenment and things like that, where people turn to the Talmud and says, are we going to say that our Talmud is some sort of a joke? We've got to spruce it up. We've got to try to get to the root of it. And that's how some understand why all of a sudden the Vilna Gaon writes a whole treatise about this. And someone in the 19th century is writing a treatise about it. And even in Sephardic lands, people are writing treatises about it. There was a desire to sort of bring it into the world of the rational and try to speak. Yes.
But it is part of the world of the rational, because the Greeks and the Romans and the Persians all appreciated these kind of clever short stories.
Mm-hmm.
So even though in Europe in the 19th century, in the 17th century, 18th century, stopped appreciating these things, perhaps,
and they said they would look at this and say, how could it be?
Mm-hmm. That a Talmudic mind would mm-hmm. write these stories. It must be there's something more behind
mm-hmm.
it. It seemed to me very fitting in the time period that these things are considered of value, clever.
Saying in trying to bring all these metaphors, maybe we're underestimating the power of just being clever. Right? In other words, the power of repartee. Right. In other words, how do you get it? How do you win friends, influence people, get to high places? And it's when someone says something, are you sharp? Can you respond to things and in their language?
Even repartee has more depth to it.
Yes, that's true.
If you look at Plato is preserved, but also the clouds are preserved. The clouds is like a comedy from the Greeks. So
that doesn't mean a belief in what is the Talmud. So I agree that the Talmud in non-halachic parts has all kinds of stuff in it. Dislogy, sayings, there's no end to what kinds of stuff it is. So is this also part of the frivolous part of the Talmud? This is not the average story in the Talmud. Most stories are less silly than they are in it. But is this sort of part of a different tradition, or is it part of that more intellectual tradition that's more dialectical and it has to do with different debates that the rabbis had? So is it more connected to other parts?
There were so many of these sages at that time,
mm-hmm.
and they were the high intellects. And you wonder if the Greek thought attracted them as it was in Maimonides' day.
Mm-hmm.
He tried the same kind of situation.
And it is in our day with Western culture.
To speak to their own.
mentioned that maybe Acher, at least about who, maybe he was attracted to Gnosticism or some other attractive belief at that time. But I generally like to think that the rabbis they suggest that they had a different, totally different way of thinking. The reason they're so terse, they don't have any essays about anything. There's no essay from Hillel. He refused to write an essay. That was considered going Jewish way. Is you submit a pithy statement. Yes, no, you redraw. That's how we think. That's how we write. That's how we transmit. I think it was very, probably very deliberate. What's this? Right, probably the Talmud world is a small world in the right. And only a certain number of people can memorize all these things and all that. Yes, the Yiddish information that works very well in those stories where he asks a question and he says, what?
In any event, so I hope you've enjoyed, and